right, so this time I talked to Michael Kazin, who is the author of, most recently, What It Took to Win, A History of the Democratic Party. And I read this book for a project that all the juniors have to do at the end of the year for history. And I wrote a lot about populism in America and tracing the roots of populism throughout history, as well as the party swap. And I think that's really interesting, especially given the things that are going on now. So from that book, I kind of wanted to delve deeper into these questions I had and also talk to Michael Kazin about what he thinks, how he thinks populism has been impacting current events, and just overall get his historical perspective on everything that's been going on now. And so this conversation really ranges from talking about history and talking about populism and talking about the party swap to also talking about how these things impact the midterms, the court system, especially Roe v. Wade. We talk about the January 6th riots and also the hearings that have followed them. I think it's just overall an amazing conversation, and I'm so thankful to have had it. So with that, here you go.
Okay. Yep.
All right. So I guess I just wanted to start with asking how your perception of American history changed when you were writing What It Took to Win.
Well, since I'm 74 years old and I've been a historian for at least half that time, if not more, I'm not saying my views changed that much, but I learned a lot about the Democratic Party I didn't know about before. And I've always been on the left, the progressive politically. And I think, as you know, reading the book, like the Democratic Party to be a party more for progressive change. It has been at different times in history. Right now it is trying to be, it's not doing a very good job of it. So I think I learned more about the institution itself, how it developed, when it was successful at winning elections, because the title of the book, after all, is What It Took to Win. And you can't really change a policy, government policy in America, unless you win elections. So that's obviously the connection is very direct there. So I just deepened my knowledge of the party's history, and also found some more continuities in the history than I really expected to find in some ways. You know, historians always talk about discontinuities and continuities, you know, what sort of the structures of politics or ideologies of politics just last and not permanent, but they endure, and what, you know, changes. And of course, history is about change, but everything doesn't change. Some structures in history don't change as quickly anyway. So I learned a lot about that relationship too, between what changed and how it changed and what hasn't changed so much.
Yeah. I think that one of the things that's really interesting and that kind of tends to get forgotten when we're talking about the Democratic Party is like the very like racist roots that the Democratic Party had. And how do you think you can still see those today in today's Democratic Party?
Well, I think actually that's one of the big changes in the history of the party. One of the discontinuities certainly was where the Democrats went from being the party of the White South, which they had been since the beginnings of the party in the early 19th century. The party which supported slavery, which supported Jim Crow, to being the party which now is the party that most African Americans vote for, most people of color vote for, and the party which really took the lead on passing civil rights bills, passing voting rights bills, passing open housing bills. And it's of course not done everything to attack racial inequality in America. There's still racial inequality in America, but you know, I think, I don't want to say the Republicans are a more racist party, that's a little too strong, but they certainly are a party that has opposed, I think, making progress towards racial equality, let's put it that way, more than the Democrats have, since the 1960s especially. And so, you know, I think the Democrat Party did turn around, and part of that was because they always believed in equal rights as a doctrine of the party, even though they were hypocritical about it when it came to people of color. But several things happened in the 1930s, for example, the rise of the labor movement, which was an interracial labor movement for the first time in American history, the industrial unions of the CIO, auto workers, meat packers, electrical workers, others, steel workers, coal miners. And so those interracial unions began to push the party, which was still dependent to a certain degree on the White South to win majorities in Congress and to win the presidency to begin to change. And that change really didn't happen fully until the 1960s, but I think it has now. So the, I think you can say the Democrats now are at least in doctrine very much an anti-racist party. Now, of course, there's a lot more to be done because the structural racism in this country, which is even if it's illegal to discriminate on the basis of race against individuals, there's still ways in which, of course, because of historical inequalities that Black people and sometimes other people of color too are treated unequally in terms of where they live, in terms of schools, in terms of environmental hazards and so forth. And Democrats have not done as much as they might to attack those sources of inequality.
Yeah. And I definitely think that, you know, one of the things you bring up in your book and that I find interesting about American history, especially is, as you were mentioning the, you know, interracial labor movement, I was kind of thinking, even though there have been these kinds of movements in the past, I feel like we've never really seen a party for all the people in the sense of now a lot of Democrats and a lot of Republicans would disagree. And you know, a lot of the poor white people are voting with Republicans. So I guess my question to you is if you think we have ever seen a party that is truly for all the people.
Not really, but then, you know, it's not easy to be a party for all the people. After all, this is a big country. It gets bigger and bigger in terms of population all the time. It's always been very diverse, ethnically diverse, racially diverse, religiously diverse, regionally diverse. So it's a lot easier to be a party for all the people, say in Denmark, where until recently, most people were, you know, Scandinavian, white, you know, Protestant. Now there's a lot of Islamic people live there, but still, the large majority of people are still white and Christian, at least in their background. So especially also when you have two big parties, as we've always really had, arguably since the 1830s, Whigs and Democrats, and then since the late 1850s, Democrats and Republicans, each party, of course, claims it's a party for all the people. But what does that actually mean? Is it a party for people who don't vote for them? Not really, because after all, to be successful, a party has to at least try to reward people who vote for them. And sometimes that means hurting people who didn't vote for them. For example, right now, if the Democrats are going to take stands and promote policies which people of Black Lives Matter support, people who hate Black Lives Matter, people who you might say are, you know, don't think racial inequality is a problem, for example, are not going to like that. So how can it be a party for all the people in that sense, right? It sounds good. And both parties say they're a party for all the people these days. Nobody anymore wants to leave anybody out rhetorically. But, you know, in fact, no party can be in this country a party for all the people. It's impossible.
Yeah. And I guess, okay, so where do you see populism going in the future? Where do you see the Republican Party going in the future, especially in relation to populism?
Well, because they define populism. I wrote a whole book on this called The Populist Persuasion back 27 years ago, way before you were born. And my definition of populism is different from some people's. My definition of populism basically is a language. It's a way of talking about politics, honoring the great majority, hardworking, patriotic majority, moral majority, to use that term, against an immoral elite. That elite can be cultural, political, economic, all three sometimes. So populism has been around in American history for a very long time, if you accept that definition. And it's got to be around for a long time, I think, because there's always people who feel that the elite, however they define that, is betraying their ideals, hurting their interests, conspiring against them, corrupt, all these adjectives you can imagine. So I think it'll continue. And Democrats do best, to return to the subject of my book, What It Took to Win, Democrats do best, I think, when they talk about economic populism, when they talk about a fairly small group, whether financial elite, corporate elites, industrial elites, who have too much power in the economy and too much power in politics too. And because, and when they say that most people, most ordinary people who work for a living are, don't have as much power as the big financial economic interests do. That's economic populism. And Democrats do best when they talk that way, I think, and carry out policies which will help the large majority against the smaller economic elite. So I think Democrats, if they want to succeed in the future, will have to keep talking that way. Republicans, on the other hand, and Donald Trump is a good example of this, often talk about the government as being, you know, the worst elite, government bureaucrats. Remember, Donald Trump talked about draining the swamp, you know, in Washington, D.C., and he ran against Washington, ran against the bureaucracy, what conservatives call the administrative state. The Supreme Court is with him in a lot of those ways as well, and some of the rulings. So, and they'll keep talking that way because it's been successful for them too in different ways. So both major parties have their own way of using populist rhetoric, I think, to help themselves when they help themselves. It's more difficult when you're in power, because when you're in power, of course, you are the elite, political elite anyway, and you have to work with other people who have power. And so it's more difficult. When you're out of power, you can use populist rhetoric, but of course you use it to get into power. Right. So that's the trade-off there.
Do you think that the January 6th riots have changed populism at all in the context of modern American history and especially in republicanism?
I'm not sure they changed populism per se. I mean, I think, I hope they have changed people's idea of the threats to democracy. It's the first time in American history that you ever had a losing political party, at least its key activists, and the president who lost actually try to overturn an election. That's never happened right. On a national level before. So again, my definition of populism, that's if anything anti-populist, because democracy is the rule of the people, which the root of populism is populus, which is people in Latin. That's where the term comes from. It was coined in the 1890s to be the adjectival form of the People's Party, which was the, you know, a left-wing third party in America in the 1890s. So, you know, I think if anything, the January 6th insurrection was an example of, I wouldn't call it fascist per se, but certainly overturning an election, using force to overturn an election. That's the kind of thing that fascists historically have done in Italy, in Germany in the 1930s, some other countries as well.
Right. But I guess my thinking is that there was a very populist sentiment behind it
I see what you mean. Yeah, the idea that the election was stolen by the government, by some corrupt elite. You know, I think that's right.
Right.
And a lot of Republicans still believe that. I think recent polls, a majority of Republicans think the election was stolen, even though I don't think they've never put forth anything like a convincing argument about how it was stolen. They've tried very hard, but every court has turned that down. And even most Republican politicians these days are beginning to move away from that, I think, even though most Republican voters still aren't.
Yeah, so I think more so than just, you know, populism in general, like in terms of what we've seen, like you were saying, with this is the first time that we've ever seen, you know, a losing party do this type of thing with an incumbent president. How do you think that will change the way people see populism?
Well, again, you know, I don't just keep disagreeing with you, but if populism is a language, then people will keep using it, you know? I don't know. I do think it's possible that if most Republicans come to actually say, you know, Biden probably won that election fairly, you know, maybe Rudy Giuliani, all these other people who were, and Trump himself were trying to fool us. Well, maybe they'll begin to see the real conspiracy against the people on the Republican side, as opposed to on the Democratic side. I think that's in fact what happened. There was a failed conspiracy, luckily. So I'd be fine with that definition of populism. And I don't know whether that'll be accepted or not, because, you know, after all, look, we're in a very sharply divided country, as you know, politically and culturally to some degree as well. Look at issues like abortion, for example, or teaching about racism, for example, too. And I think it's unlikely we're going to sort of have one party or the other get a in position to be the dominant party again, as the Democrats were, you know, between the 1930s and early 1970s, the Republicans were during the Civil War and really in part of the late 19th century, Democrats were in the early 19th century. I think it's unlikely, just because I could talk about that, you know, if you want. You know, there's lots of reasons why about half the voters, about half, a little less than half, vote Republican are likely to keep voting Republican, and half the voters, or maybe a little more, will keep voting for Democrats. Cultural reasons, regional reasons. Each group suspects the other group of being, you might say, you know, wanting to destroy what they hold dear. And,
right.
And when you have that lack of trust, lack of respect for the other side, almost complete lack of respect and trust in the other side, that's hard to, just like with individual, you know, relationships, that's hard to heal.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's going to, I hope it gets healed before I, while I'm still alive. I hope it gets certainly healed before you get much older, but I just don't know. It depends what happens.
Yeah. And I do definitely want to talk about polarization. That's like one of the things I had on my little list here. Sure. So how do you see polarization in the context of history? And I would definitely like to hear some of the reasons why you think that we've become this very polarized nation in a way that we certainly were not during, you know, the time like the Civil War and Democratic powerhouse.
Well, the Civil War, we were polarized.
Well, sorry. I mean,
it was
like
the Civil War.
Yeah, right.
that's sort of as polarized as you can get.
I know.
Like kill the other side. Yeah.
I misspoke.
I know what you mean. Yeah. I mean, there. To be honest with you, you know, historically, I'm a historian here. This is not unusual. You know, people would like it to be unusual, but we mentioned the Civil War. Of course, Civil War happened. Happened because of the South wanting to retain slavery, but it happened specifically because the South wouldn't accept the results of a presidential election, right? 1860. Lincoln won more popular votes than anybody else, but only won 40% of the popular vote. But of course, he won the electoral vote rather easily. And the Southern, most Southerners voted for a Southern Democrat, even the Democratic Party split too. And there were two Democratic candidates. One of the reasons why Lincoln was able to win. So Southerners didn't accept the results of that vote. And they said, if Lincoln's gonna be president, this guy who wants to end slavery eventually, though not right away, he never said he wanted to end it right away, but he did, of course, help to end it eventually. We can't stay in this country. So that's that's polarization. And also late 19th century, when the two parties were fairly equal in strength, Democrats accused the Republicans of being a party that wanted to help Black people and hurt white people, a party that wanted to help the big corporations as opposed to the ordinary working class white people. And Republicans accused the Democrats of being the racist party, which they were, but also of being a party that didn't believe in helping the economy prosper. And then there was a period in the early, the first part of the 20th century and on to the really after World War II as well, where you might say progressives in both parties, what we now call liberals in both parties, were powerful. There were liberal Republicans and liberal Democrats. There were conservative Democrats and conservative Republicans. And so it was possible for the conservatives in both parties to unite around certain issues and liberals in both parties to unite around certain issues. And so you had polarization ideologically, but not between the parties. Without going into a lot more detail on this, this begins, I think, to fall apart in the late 1970s, early 1980s, when conservatives begin to coalesce around the Republican Party. White Southerners who had voted for Democrats pretty consistently, even if they didn't like liberals who sometimes ran the party under Franklin Roosevelt, for example, or John Kennedy, nevertheless had voted for Democrats because of the history of the Confederacy and the Civil War and all that. But that began to change. Ronald Reagan won all the Southern states, but Jimmy Carter's home state of Georgia in 1980, devout evangelicals, white evangelicals who had been as much Democrats, Republicans, begin to gravitate towards being Republicans. And in general, conservatives and liberals sort themselves out, liberals being almost all in the Democratic Party, conservatives being almost all in the Republican Party. And that's really, we've had that for more than 40 years. And if you have that kind of polarization, which lasts a long time, and it's, I could talk about different times when it's been, you know, fell apart a little bit, 1990s for a little bit, but basically it's been strengthened. And when you have also, neither party can win presidential elections, can win congressional elections consistently, that encourages polarization. Because, you know, if it seems like if you help the other party at all, if you vote for the other party at all, it's going to help the other party win, then there's a lot of reason not to vote the other party, even if you agree with them. For example, take Susan Collins, the senator from Maine, who's, you know, about as liberal as you can get as a Republican senator these days. You know, she's pro-choice. You know, she's for abortion rights, as you probably know. Only one of two senators who is. Murkowski is the other one from Alaska. And then, you know, she in the congressional hearings when Kavanaugh was testifying, she talked to him and she was sure that he was going to let Roe v. Wade stand. Well, of course, last week, he was one of the five justices who voted to overturn Roe v. Wade. She said she was very unhappy that he told her something different. Well, whether or not she's being honest about that, I don't know. But it's also pretty clear that if she voted against him, she would have gotten hell from other Republicans who saw an opportunity for their side to have a majority in the Supreme Court. And she probably would have gotten a very strong primary rival from conservatives in the Republican Party in Maine and might have lost her seat. So that's an example of how there's really very little room in either party, and this I'm just talking about Republicans here, for to differ with the majority opinion in your party. Because you're gonna lose. Look, you know, there've been, since Richard Nixon resigned the presidency in 1974, there've been 12 presidential elections. Republicans have won six, Democrats have won six. No party since Jimmy Carter left office has controlled both the presidency and both houses of Congress for more than 2 years at a time, which is kind of amazing. And that was not true in most American history. So people who were winning presidential elections easily, like Ronald Reagan, didn't control Congress for more than 2 years. Both houses, that is, at a time. Barack Obama, who won easily the first time at least, did not control Congress for more than 2 years at a time. And it's pretty clear, unfortunately, from my point of view, that Joe Biden will probably lose, Democrats probably lose control, at least of the House of Representatives in the election this fall. So that means that polarization continues because neither party wants to give an inch to the other party because they might lose the next election.
So speaking about the midterms, there's a very clear trend here historically, and that has held really steadfast throughout a lot of American history, like you were saying. Has anything about the midterm elections surprised you?
Well, it hasn't started yet, really, but not really. I mean, the problem, of course, is that, again, being a historian here, I don't know if you know, but there's only two elections since the Civil War where a new president, his party has picked up seats in the presidential election.
Yeah.
1934 and 2002, the only times, and unusual circumstances in each time. The depression was getting a little bit better. Franklin Roosevelt was very, very popular in 34. He's creating public jobs for a lot of people. And the Republican Party was still seen as a party of big business that had caused the depression. 2002, George W. Bush was still basking in the aura of being the anti-terrorist president who led the country to fight back against the Muslims terrorists who bombed the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. But that's unusual. So I'm not surprised. Normally, the new president's party does lose seats in the midterm. What surprised me and saddened me as a Democrat is that Joe Biden has not been able to retain enough popularity by getting for other Democrats to pass bills that would help his popularity. But again, it shouldn't have surprised me because the Democrats have such narrow majorities, 6 seats in the House and no majority in the Senate, except, of course, when Vice President Harris can break a tie vote. So when you have such narrow majorities, it's very, very difficult to pass far-reaching bills. It's never happened in American history where a party has been able to pass far-reaching legislation that it wants to pass with such narrow majorities. So it shouldn't have surprised me. It shouldn't have surprised Democrats that they have not been able to do that, but they haven't. And obviously, inflation, the disastrous pullout from Afghanistan, Biden's lack of charisma, let's put it that way. He's not a very inspiring leader. He's a comfortable guy, but he's not very inspiring at all. All that is obviously hurting Democrats. And maybe the backlash from the court's decision in Roe v. Wade will help Democrats. So we'll have to see.
Yeah. So speaking of Roe v. Wade, something I didn't find in What It Took to Win, but I'm sure you've written about before, is how the courts have played a role in American history. And more specifically, do you think that for the most part, there's been a trend of the courts going with public opinion or against public opinion? And how do you see that playing out?
Yeah, great question. Well, of course, until the 1930s, there were no public opinion polls. So it's hard to know exactly what public opinion was earlier. So we don't know whether the Dred Scott decision was for public opinion or not. It certainly helped bring on the Civil War, so it was disastrous, but it doesn't mean that a majority of Americans, if they'd been asked in a poll, wouldn't have supported it. I don't know. Hard to know. But the court, of course, is set up not to be, it's not elected. They don't have term limits, where I think they should, but they don't. And so in that sense, they inure from public opinion, and they're supposed to follow the law, supposed to follow precedents in the Constitution as they define them. But of course, the Constitution, as you know, is a pretty vague document in many ways. even with amendments, a pretty vague document. And what does it mean, for example, to have equal protection of the laws, due process of law? What does it mean to be a person, in fact? All these things are up for debate and have always been in many ways. So in that sense, the court usually doesn't get too far behind public opinion, but they don't have to care, obviously. And that's a problem, maybe, you can see. And it's always been political too. I mean, that's the thing that those who think the court's above the battle and tries to be, well, the justices might think they are above the battle, just following the law, but it's very clear someone appoints them who has politics, who wants his, so far only his politics, someday soon, I hope we'll have a woman president, but we haven't yet, wants his politics to be reflected on the court. And when it's not, the president who appoints that person feels betrayed. Good example, the most liberal court in American history, led by Earl Warren, who was Chief Justice from 1953 to 1969, was appointed by a Republican, by Dwight D. Eisenhower, not a very conservative Republican, but nevertheless a Republican. And Earl Warren actually ran for vice president in 1948 on the Republican ticket and had been a Republican governor of California before then. Well, when he became a great liberal justice, Dwight Eisenhower, the president of the United States, very popular president, said appointing Earl Warren was the first worst decision he ever made because he didn't expect this guy to be an effective Democrat and liberal Democrat at that. So that's an example, I think, of how the court's always been very political. And, public opinion can be gauged in different ways, but clearly the court likes to be on the right side of public opinion, but sometimes justices much more likely want to follow their idea of what the Constitution really says. And I take conservatives who I don't agree with very seriously. I think they try to do that, but it's not surprising that they end up supporting stands that conservatives outside the court also support.
Yeah. So what do you make of, I personally, maybe this is just my personal belief, but I kind of feel like this idea that the justices really do try to take into consideration what the Constitution says has been a little bit challenged by the Roe v. Wade decision. So I guess I'm wondering what you would make of this decision in that context.
Well, the problem is, again, is that if you look, I don't know if you've looked at the history of Roe v. Wade, but the decision was based on a right to privacy, which Harry Blackmun, who wrote the decision, found in the Constitution, which is actually based on earlier decisions, especially the Griswold decision, which is the one that basically said states can't ban the sale of birth control devices and birth control pills to people. Originally to married people, but it was extended very quickly to everybody, everybody over 18 at least. And so now there is no right to privacy specifically in the Constitution, certainly. But individual rights are mentioned in the Constitution, not in so many words, but basically, and right to association. And there's a general sense that people have that America is a country of individual liberty, individual freedom, that people make, unless they're hurting other people, committing crimes against other people, they get to do what they want, you know. And this obviously goes against that. So constitutionally, you know, you can argue that conservatives obviously have argued that it's not constitutional. And no less a justice than Ruth Bader Ginsburg, as you might know, who of course was very much in favor of abortion rights, did say, you know, in 2013 and sometimes earlier, she wished that that decision had been made by the court, because public opinion, talk about public opinion, was changing on abortion, and more states were beginning to legalize their abortion laws, including California, under Governor Ronald Reagan, who signed a very liberal abortion law in 1967, the first year when he was governor. So she wished this had been decided by the states, by legislatures and governors voting. I think she's right. I think that's, she was a heroine of mine, and I think it would be much better if that had happened that way, but it didn't. And of course, once people get used to having that right, which they've had for 49 years, they don't want to give it up. And I do think myself that whether constitutional or not, people should be able to control their own bodies, and women should have the right to decide if they want to have children or not. And it shouldn't be up to the state to do that. But that's my sense of morality. Constitutionally, I'm afraid you can probably have it both ways.
So you bring up this interesting, you know, that
I should say just one more quick thing. The Constitution is a very conservative document. We forget that, you know.
Yeah.
It was written by a bunch of white men 5 years ago, you know.
Yeah.
Amended, you know, 27, 28 times since then, but still, the basic Constitution, the basic structure of government we have is still the one that was agreed on in 1787.
You know, you brought up this idea that Roe v. Wade has been around for 50 years, and so people have gotten used to that, right? You know, I also think it's interesting that they've chosen to kind of put aside stare decisis. And I guess I'm wondering what you see of that, what you think of that.
Well, I'm not a lawyer, but obviously the conservatives argue that, well, Plessy v. Ferguson, the case which of course said it was fine to have separate equal facilities for black and white people on trains originally, but then it got extended to segregation generally. That was overruled for education, of course, by Brown v. Board of Education 54, which was, you know, 58 years later. So again, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a constitutional scholar at all. But I think, you know, if a case was wrongly decided and has hurt a lot more people than it's helped, there's nothing wrong with overturning it from my point of view. Again, that's just my point of view. But of course, I don't think Roe v. Wade has hurt more people than it's helped. So that's my own personal opinion about that. So, but I think generally, you know, the Dred Scott decision, which said a black person could not be a citizen, that was overturned by the Civil War and by the 14th Amendment. So it was overturned very quickly, but not by a court case, but by the government did. And look, I think you know, if Democrats had large enough majorities, they would now be clearly voting to make Roe v. Wade or abortion rights more generally, you know, the law of the land, and it'd be a lot more difficult for the court to overturn that because it wouldn't be. It's an act of Congress rather than a decision of the court. And that's acts of Congress are harder in almost every case the more difficult for the court to legitimize overturning them. Not that many acts of Congress have been overturned by the court.
Right. So I'm going to also talk about quickly, I wasn't planning on doing a lot of current events, but I guess it's just like it's become so relevant over the past couple of days.
Yeah, and probably your large audience would like to hear more about it. So.
Yeah.
But I can't stay on too much longer because I gotta get dinner underway. So.
Okay. So just quickly, I know you tweeted that, you know, the hearings would blow the roof off of Congress. So what about the hearings surprised you?
I didn't tweet that. I was quoting Jamie Raskin, Congressman.
Yes, sorry.
Yeah, yes. who's a friend of mine and a great guy. Everyone should read his book about the suicide of his son and the what happened on January 6th. But anyway.
So what about the hearings surprised you?
How well done they have been. How well orchestrated they are. You know, I'm not a big fan of the Cheneys politically, but clearly Liz Cheney has been masterful at her questioning. It's really been anti-Trump Republicans testifying against Trump, what he did. I mean, that's really been the germ of the hearing, at least so far. Most likely will continue to be. Because that's, of course, those are the people who know what Trump did. Democrats were not in there hearing about what Trump was doing and saying. The testimony yesterday by Cassie Hutchinson certainly surprised me. I never heard of her before. Most Americans didn't. The fact that she was there, you know, listening to these people, basically, especially hearing about the President Trump saying it's fine to have people with weapons at his rally and by extension, have weapons take to the Capitol, you know. I mean, how brazen Trump was in believing that whatever it takes to overturn this election, I'm fine with. That's basically what is coming out from these hearings, which is, you know, very scary, clearly. Other than that, you know, I think a lot of people have said this, but I think it's true that it was a big mistake for the Republicans not to nominate some people who Nancy Pelosi would have accepted, and that she didn't accept people who clearly were in favor of overturning the election, but she would have accepted people who would have made it much harder for Liz Cheney and the Democrats on the committee to make the case they want to make against Trump. So in that sense, it surprised me that the Republicans, who are usually pretty smart politically, didn't realize that if they had people on the hearings would not have much impact. But they were hearing from their own constituents, their own loyalists, saying, can't be part of that hearing, you know, it's just going to help the Democrats. Can't do that. So they didn't want to legitimize the hearing, so they didn't do it. So that surprised me. But, you know, how much impact the hearing is going to have, I just don't know. My son, who's Democratic Party operative, is dubious how much impact it's going to have. We'll have to see. I think it basically just hardens opinions on both sides. To the extent that it convinces some Republicans, you know, Donald Trump was really doing some scary things here, that's a good thing. And I hope that's going to happen. I don't know.
Yeah. All right. So if there's anything else you would like to add, I will leave the floor.
No, I just think, you know, it's impressive that, you know, you've studied seriously history and politics, and you ask great questions, and hope the podcast prospers, and I'd be curious to hear what you'll say and hopefully write in the future.
All right. Thank you so much. I'm going to stop recording.